And welcome back to the Omban. I'm Matt Ferreira.
And I'm Ezra.
And we're just going to hop right into it. We actually got a little bit of baseball news this week. Start right up with it. I'll let Ezra start off.
So the first big thing is I saw a tweet the other day from it was a report by Buster Only. It said that the Tigers had offered Carlos Correa, big name in free agency still out there, a 10-year, $275 million contract, and they were willing to go up to nearly 300 mil. And I just thought that was pretty astounding that he declined that, honestly. We saw Seager got a similar deal of 325 mil with the Rangers, and just seeing Correa decline that deal definitely means he wants that same amount of money as Seager. And I know we put them both on very similar playing fields when it comes to best shortstops in the game. They're both up there. But I delved into some research to see who really deserved that $325 million. And I'm honestly gonna take a shot here and just say I feel like Corey Seager deserves it. And I think that Correa should have taken that 10 275. Obviously, the Tigers ended up getting Javi Baez for half the money they were willing to spend on Correa, which might help them in the long run. But if you just look at the baseball savant, you look at all of the percentiles for guys, Correa and for Seager, you just look at the average exit velocity. Correa is only in the 70th percentile, while Seager's in the 81st hard hit percentage. He's 90th, whereas Correa's only 62nd percentile. Obviously, Seager does whiff more often than Correa, so that's another thing. A little bit slower, chases more often, and the outs above average is the most daunting stat. Seager's only in the 6th percentile, whereas Correa's in the 98th. But it comes down to that hard hit percentage for me. It's almost a 30% difference, and Correa wants the same amount of money. Obviously, he chases less, but he hits the ball less, not as hard, but more often. The barrel percentage for Seager, 81%, compared to Correa's 60%. It's just really what's standing out to me when you look at comparing those contracts and comparing the metrics that those guys have. I don't know how you feel, Matt, but I feel like Correa's probably asking for a little too much if we're comparing it to similar deals.
Well, the way I look at it is, yes, Corey Seager's a little bit better with his bat, well, actually hitting the ball, but I think looking at the way the game has evolved from more, not even evolved, maybe even devolved from going from a game that where most of the players are just trying to hit contact, 330 was like an average that was always the highest. Now the like batting title winner could be hitting 310. So the game has definitely changed more in Seager's favor of hitting it harder and further compared to hitting it more often. But I think the big difference is defense, and that Carlos Correa is one of, if not the best defensive shortstops in the entire league, while Corey Seager has always been known just as a bat.
Yeah, and I see that, but I also feel like as the game has devolved, it's also become less about that defensive aspect. I know it's really important, and I think it's very important. I would rather have a team that doesn't make a single error all year, you know. But with the current state of the game, I just feel like I'm so sorry, we're virtual right now, so dogs are going to interrupt me. But as I was saying, the need for defense is a lot less important, I feel like, to teams at this point, which is why I feel like the difference between Seager and Correa contracts should be a lot, not a lot bigger, but I feel like Seager should be getting less, should be getting more, pardon, than Correa is asking for.
I see what you're saying, but at the same time, I think especially the teams, especially ones that want to contend, like, and a prime example here is the Mets, like looking at their defense and how it killed them last year. I think especially at shortstop in the outfield, it's two of the most, like the most,
The pinnacle
need
of
the most
defense.
defense. Yeah, you need the most defense in those positions. So especially the commanders of the field. I just think that Correa is going to get more money. Might not be as much, might be around 330, 340, but I know he said Didn't he say he wasn't going to take less than Lindor did too?
Yeah, I think he did say that. But also something I neglected to mention earlier is another thing about the hitting that's really standing out to me is that last year in 2021, Correa saw 58% fastballs, whereas Seager saw 47% fastballs and 34% breaking pitches, as opposed to Correa only seeing 30% breaking pitches. And that's another thing that really did stand out to me, because if Seager's hitting that much better, seeing that many fewer fastballs, you've got to imagine if he's in a lineup where Simeon's around him with Adolis Garcia around him, he's going to be seeing even more fastballs than he already was. And he's just going to hit those like crazy, because last year against fastballs, Corey Seager hit 369 and slugged 638. You have to imagine those numbers are really standing out to people, especially considering Correa against fastballs was only hitting 292 with a slugging slightly below 500. It stands out a lot to me. And that's just, I think that the contracts should be similar, but I feel like Seager is probably a little more deserving of that 300 plus contract than Correa is.
Yeah, for bat wise, I would definitely say Seager is. I mean, another thing that I think about Correa is their ballpark. I mean, their left field is really short. The Crawford boxes have been well known to help Astros with Altuve and Correa. They hit a lot of home runs out there in the shorter left field. So I think that Correa's home run numbers even may take a dip after he signs with a new team.
Yeah, and you know, there's a lot that can go differently with different teams, different atmospheres, different lineups. You never really know, but that's just my thoughts. And now, Matt, I know you mentioned defense for the Mets, but let's talk about that managerial spot, the newest member of the long line of Mets managers is Buck Showalter, the former Orioles, D-backs, Yankees, and Rangers manager. I know a lot about him, having him in Baltimore for 9 years. And I know you know a lot about him, facing him in Baltimore for 9 years. So, Matt, I'll let you start with this one. How do you feel about Buck?
I mean, I think it was someone the Mets had to get. Once Scherzer came out and said that he wanted him, it was one of the things that the Mets just had to do. Something interesting I found was from The Athletic. The Mets are the fifth team Showalter has taken over, and none of the previous four clubs had a winning record in the season before he came. So, I mean, if he's coming around and he's taking teams to the playoffs after they're dead last in their division and not having winning records, I'm pretty sure he's going to do really good with a team that has Max Scherzer and Jacob deGrom as the 1-2 punch.
Well, yeah, if we look at the beginning of his managerial career, his second year with the Yankees, he was runner-up in manager of the year and then won it the next year in 94. He was fourth place in 95. In 99, he was also in fourth place, won it in 2004 with the Rangers, came second with the Orioles, and in 2012. In 2014, he won it with the Orioles. 2016, came in third. The guy is a master of controlling a baseball game. I know that as an Orioles fan, I loved him. And in a five-year span, between 2012 season and the 2016 season, there are only three teams in the major leagues with better records than the Orioles. In those seasons, the Orioles had 444 wins. And the only three teams to have more were the Dodgers with 455, the Cardinals with 461, and the Nationals with 458. The Dodgers won their division, I think, all but one of those years. And it's just a testament to how good of a manager Buck's is going to be for the Mets and has been in the past. And I know that his contract is up. The contract he signed is until the end of the 2024 season. And he has a run of every season ending in four, winning the manager of the year. So that might be a sign for the Mets. maybe 2024 will finally be the year.
Yeah, I think Buck will definitely be there to change the culture for the Mets. I mean, they seem to be very blamey on, like, granted they have had a lot of injuries and stuff like that, but they, especially like some of their players seem to be a little like complaining. And
it always has to be managers is what I get from the Mets, is that every time they lose, people are blaming the managers. And I think that this is finally a time that they won't have to blame the manager.
Exactly.
And that's huge. I think that the Mets have a history of, you know, not being the greatest. And I'm just really excited to see what they can do with Lindor, with all these new signings, with Scherzer and DeGrom 1-2 punch, with a manager who has so much experience and good experience, and just to be able to see what they do with all of that possibility, with all that potential.
Yeah, we've seen some older managers take teams far, with Dusty Baker in the Astros last year. Tony La Russa made the playoffs in his first year in Chicago. It's really interesting to see all these old managers are making comebacks.
It's the old school coming back to school, the new school, really.
Yeah.
And just a quick little funny story that Matt shared with me via Instagram. Another Buck, another Oriole Buck, Buck Britton, AAA manager for the Orioles, is brothers with Zach Britton. And considering the current lockout, they're actually not supposed to speak, because the players aren't supposed to be in contact with the MLB employees like a manager is. So I'll be curious to see how that Christmas party shakes out.
Yeah, Zach Britton actually joked and he said that they're going to stay on the other side of the room so that they wouldn't get in trouble.
That would be really funny to see if they actually did get in trouble for that. I honestly think it's insane that, you know, brother and brother can't speak, but it's kind of funny, honestly.
Yeah, it's one of the funny stories about the lockout, especially with, we got some huge baseball families that kids and brothers, and they all play, like the Guerreros and Biggios and pretty much any prospect on the Blue Jays.
Yeah, you know, you can just keep rolling off names, but it's just weird to see these guys having to completely disregard what they were disregarding before, thinking of it as nothing. And now they actually have to think of who they can talk to, when they can talk to them, anything of the sort. It's just funny to think about, really.
Yeah, and what they're talking about and stuff like that, and trying not to give away stuff that they're thinking of so that they could use it as leverage against the MLB.
It's just a lot. And speaking of this lockout, there's a lot of things that can't happen. But something that did just come up recently is Cody Bellinger did sign a new deal during the lockout. It's 1 year, 17 mil, pretty reasonable for a guy that's won the MVP and came back alive in the postseason after having a really bad regular season. But Matt, I'm honestly confused on how this is possible.
Yeah, I have no clue how it happened, because I thought teams and players weren't going to be able to talk during this, but I know it was to avoid arbitration, so it may have been something that the MLB had talked about before, and it could be something that Bellinger and the Dodgers could have talked about before but kept secret.
Yeah, and with the arbitration, it's all about the law. It's like what they would make legally, stuff like that, and using lawyers to negotiate contracts. So that's the only way I think I could conceivably understand how this happened, or that they kept it secret, like you said. But it's just, again, another weird thing coming out of this lockout that I don't think anybody is fully understanding.
Yeah, and I was actually really surprised when I saw the news. I mean, Bellinger had a rough 2021. I think he was
statistically one of the worst players in baseball last year.
Yeah, he hit 165 with a 240 on base and a 302 slugging, and he's going to make $900,000 more than he did last year. It's just interesting that the Dodgers didn't just let him go through arbitration so that they could pay him less. But on the flip side, I know after next year, Cody Bellinger is a free agent. So it could be the Dodgers saying, we believe in you. We know you're going to bounce back. So that after this year, they can give him a long-term contract and say, remember when we believed in you? Maybe try it lowball a little bit.
Yeah, that's definitely, it's definitely a possibility. I think there's a lot of things that could come of this. I also think it could totally backfire in the Dodgers' face because they can't really spread that contract out, but we'll see how it plays out. There's a lot of possibilities, and honestly, I like Cody Bellinger. He's a fun guy, and I really hope that he does get that bounce back year and shows that he's worth that 17 mil. Honestly, it's just going to be something we need to watch throughout the entirety of the season.
Yeah, it'll be interesting to see. I mean, I know he was a big step for the Dodgers in the playoffs. I think the big thing with him is, much like Correa, you can always rely on his defense no matter if his bat's hot or cold. He's one of the best center fielders defensively in the league, and he can play right field. He could play first base for you. He's a versatile guy too. So, and a big lefty bat at that, that can, as we saw last year, can bat anywhere from 2 to 8 in your lineup.
And there's just the versatility is a big thing for me in baseball. I want a guy that can play all those positions. So Bellinger, again, confused on how the deal got done, but I don't hate the deal. I think it's probably going to end up being worthwhile. And that, with that, I don't really have a smooth transition from point A to point B, but today's bigger part of the episode is something that Matt came up with the other day, and I will let you talk about what we're doing today.
So I was scrolling through Instagram actually, and I saw this, and it was a snake draft for pitch arsenals. So you see your current players, so like you would draft DeGrom slider or like something like that. Like each player has their own pitch. Like Corbin Burns' cutter got him all, pretty much got him the Cy Young single-handedly last year. So it's to see what pitches could make the best pitcher overall.
And we're doing snake draft. And considering you got to get the second pick last time, I'm going to make the executive decision and say, now you get the first pick. So Matt, you start off with your first pitch in the arsenal. By the way, we're doing 5 pitches because that seems reasonable. Now, Matt, your first pick, you're on the clock.
So I actually saw this on Pitching Ninja today, and I'm going to take DeGrom slider. Awesome. It sits high, low 90s. It moves so much. I mean, DeGrom struck out Freddie Freeman, who's one of the best hitters, with 3 straight sliders, and with each one of them in the same exact location. It's one of the dirtiest pitches in baseball. It's just an unhittable pitch, and I had to take it number one.
That is a pretty nasty pitch, and I'm actually going to follow suit with you in one facet, where my first pick is going to be DeGrom also, but I'm taking his fastball. The guy throws the ball 100 plus miles an hour. I don't need to talk about numbers or sabermetrics with this. It's DeGrom's fastball. It's upper 90s, low 100s. It can run. It's just one of the most deadly pitches in baseball, and I'm going to have to take it first overall for my arsenal. And with my second pick in my arsenal, I'm going with another guy who is pretty much unhittable because of this one pitch, and that is the two-way wonder himself, Shohei Ohtani. I'm going to have to take his splitter. I myself throw a splitter also, and I'm a huge proprietor of the splitter. So Ohtani's is probably the best in the league. And I actually have his numbers up right here. In his first year in the league, his splitter had a 56.4% whiff percentage with an opponent batting average of .036 and a slugging percentage of .055. Like, you don't get any better than that pitch. It is the epitome of a great splitter. And it hasn't gotten worse. This past season in 2021, his MVP year, a .087 batting average against the splitter with a .102 slug, a whiff percentage of 48.5. And if you compare it to all of his other pitches, the spin rate difference between them is absurd. His fastball spin is 2,217. His slider's going 2,350. And his splitter is 1,372. And I'm sure if you look at DeGrom's fastball compared to that Ohtani splitter, the spin rate difference is going to be absurd. And that's why I got to pair the two together.
I think it's a fabulous pick. I actually had Ohtani splitter on my radar. I think he is one of the best splitters in baseball, if not the best splitter in baseball. And it's a good thing to have right next to DeGrom's fastball. But moving along forward, I'm going to go with a pair of pitches from the same team, actually. I'm going to stick with the off-speed, and I'm going to take Devin Williams' changeup. One of the relievers for the Milwaukee Brewers, his changeup in 2021, which he threw 634 times, almost double compared to any other pitch he threw. It sits around 84 miles per hour, but opponents had a 161 batting average against, a 47.2 whiff percentage, and a 32.6% put-away percentage. All that with a 2,800 spin rate. In his launch, the average launch angle against it was 10 degrees. Just nobody could touch his changeup all year, and nobody's been able to figure it out in the few years he's been in the league.
And you said that these are going to be from the same team. So I'm going to take a wild guess at your next pick. You going with something from the one, the only, the Josh Hader?
I am not.
Really?
I'm actually going to take Corbin Burns' curveball.
All right.
So while he's really known for his cutter, Corbin Burns' curveball was thrown 474 times, which is more than any other off-speed pitch. And second to his cutter, it has a batting average against of .069, a whiff percentage of 50, a put away percentage of 33, a spin rate of 2,900. It's just one of those things that no one can hit. Exit velo average was 82.7. Just nobody was hitting it all year last year, and part of the reason why he won Cy Young.
All right. Well, that's not the way I thought you were going to go with that, which actually leaves me open to do something that I wasn't sure I was going to be able to do. And that's going to be get my third on my big board is another curveball, another NL Cy Young winner curveball, and possibly one of the best curveballs of all time. That's Clayton Kershaw's. The thing has some absolute crazy 12-6 movement, and it's just absurd how good that pitch has been since 2008, I believe, was Kershaw's first year in the league, maybe. It's just one of the best pitches of all time. This past year is actually the best it's been since 2017, but I'm going to bring us way back to 2011, where he threw his curveball 167 times with a whiff percentage of 47%. The batting average against his curveball has never been over 200 except for 1 year. In his best stretch of his career, it was pretty much a consistent 116 batting average against, but it's still one of the craziest pitches. That thing drops from 12 to 6 on the clock in an instant. The vertical movement on that thing is incredible. It has, in this past season, it had 65.3 inches of drop. That's just unprecedented. And that's why I'm going to have to take the Kershaw curveball as my third pitch in my arsenal, especially going along with that DeGrom fastball and Ohtani splitter. The three of those, that movement all combined, that velocity change all combined, the spin change all combined, I think that's going to be a pretty nasty 1-2-3 pitch combo, but I have to take two more pitches, even though I don't really think I need it anymore. But my next pitch is going to be one that is a little out there, but I know we all know it. And that's the Chaz Rowe slide piece. The Chaz Rowe slider, I don't think I need to really talk about how much that thing moves. I'm sure most baseball fans out there have seen how much it moves. It's a frisbee when he throws it. I'll pull up his Baseball Savant here, and the slider, the horizontal movement on his slider, he didn't pitch very often this year. I believe he got hurt this year, but the horizontal movement on his slider was nearly 25 inches at its peak. And I think that getting back to that, it's 15.1 inches more than the average slider in baseball. It's just a pitch that absolutely disappears on the hitter. So that's why I'm going to have to take Chaz Rowe, the former Oriole, mind you. His slider is the next pitch in my arsenal. Now, Matt, you have your last two picks. Where are you going?
So I'm going to start off with one of the great, I think one of the hardest to hit pitches in the MLB right now. And it is Bruiser Gratterall sinker. It averages 100 miles per hour and has 20.2 inches of drop. While opponents did hit pretty well last year against it with a 289 batting average, he was throwing it almost 60% of the time. So people pretty much knew it was coming. But even with hitting 289 off it, the average launch angle was negative 15 degrees. And it was just an effective pitch that got him ground balls and outs or strikeouts. And then to top it.
I will say, Matt, that was my next pick. So I'm a little mad that you took it. But I have backup plans. No big deal.
And to stick with relievers, I'm going to top off my arsenal with a four-seam fastball from Alex Reyes.
Oh, yeah.
He throws his fastball almost 31% of the time. In 2021, it averaged 97 miles per hour, but I've seen it get up to 105, I believe. It had an average batting average against of 207. It had a 2,400 spin rate. 24% whiff rate on a fastball is insane. It's just one of those pitches that nobody can hit. It's one of the fast. I think he's one of the fastest throwers in the MLB now, actually. And it rises 11 inches. It's insane.
Yeah, that is a pretty gosh darn good pitch. It was the second fastball I was going to pick if I didn't get to take DeGrom's, but obviously I have to take something of DeGrom's, and you took his slider. So I had to go with the fastball, and I had to leave Alex Reyes to you. And now with my last pick, I had a few ideas for this. Obviously, I already took Chaz Rowe's slider, so I'm going to have to say no to Chris Sale's slider, because that thing is filthy, but I'm not going to take that.
And shout out Tanner Houck's slider too. Pretty much the same exact thing, but from the other side.
Exactly. Those are some good pitches, but I already have a slider in my arsenal. I already have a splitter. I already have a curveball and a fastball. So it's difficult for me to decide. I was thinking maybe throw something funny in there, like the Granky Ephus pitch, because I know we all love that. But I am gonna stick with something a little funny, but something that I actually think would be incredible to add to this arsenal. And when we first discussed having this snake draft in the episode, I thought maybe we were gonna do all time, and I could pair the Wakefield knuckleball with the Mo Rivera cutter. But I am gonna stick with a knuckleball. And I know all of our MLB The Show fans love this guy. It's the greatest pitcher in MLB The Show, Mickey Janis, and I'm taking his knuckleball. The Oriole, I think that throwing that knuckleball in there would be huge. put a DeGrom fastball out there and then a Mickey Janis knuckler and then break off a Kershaw curveball. I think that's a perfect 1-2-3 combination. And that's why I'm going to have to take Mickey Janis's knuckleball as my fifth pitch in the arsenal. And with that, we are going to have our full arsenal. Matt has a four-seamer from Alex Reyes and a sinker from Brusdar Graterol. His changeup comes courtesy of Devin Williams and a curveball courtesy of his teammate Corbin Burns with Jacob DeGrom's slider. Whereas I have a lot of variety, just like Matt does with a DeGrom fastball and Ohtani splitter with the greatest, if not the greatest curveballs of all time in Kershaw. And then the craziness of the Chaz Rowe slider and Mickey Janis knuckleball. Those are two very unique combinations of pitches. And honestly, I kind of want to throw them together in the show and see what happens. And that might be something I do in my free time. Matt, of course, I'll share it with you. I might even put it up on the Arm Barn Instagram at Arm Barn Pod. So follow. But on to our last and one of my favorite things to do week in, week out, part of the episode is the Rushmores. We have two new ones, of course, this week. And I don't know why, but I really just wanted to do these teams. It seemed like they went together pretty well. The Twins and the Diamondbacks this week on Rushmore. So, Matt, what do you want to start with, the Diamondbacks or the Twins?
I'll start with the Twins.
All right. This one was a little easier for me to decide than the Diamondbacks one for sure. So, Matt, you want to start us off with this?
Yeah, so I'll go through. My number one that I had was Walter Johnson. He played with his from 1907 to 1927, spent 21 years with the Twins franchise. He had 417 wins in a career 2.17 ERA, just almost 6,000 innings, 3,500 strikeouts, Hall of Famer, two-time MVP, three Triple Crowns, five ERAs, and a World Series title to his name. One of the best pitchers of all time.
And yeah, he was fantastic. I have also got him first name that I put on my list easily. I just want to point out that he was the strikeout guy before there were strikeout guys. He had 300 plus strikeouts multiple times in his career, in the peak of his career, which obviously was his entire career because he was just that good. He was going 370 innings a year pretty much with just about 230 strikeouts, which obviously doesn't seem like a lot now, but that was huge strikeout numbers for the era. And ERA plus is another number that I put a lot of precedence in. And in one of his MVP seasons, he had an ERA plus of 259, which puts him 159 points of ERA plus above the average pitcher of the time. That's incredible. He's more than double as good as any other pitcher of the time. And that's why he's an obvious pick for this Rushmore, right?
And yeah, he's one of the best pitchers of all time, all-time leader in WAR for the Minnesota Twins franchise. To keep moving along here, I actually have the second all-time in WAR and the number one position player in WAR for the Twins is Rod Carew, lefty hitting first baseman and second baseman for the Twins for 12 years. He was an all-star all 12 of the years he played with the Twins, won an MVP, Rookie of the Year, Hall of Famer, won the batting title a few times with the Twins, actually seven times with the Twins. Just
pure hitter, that's for sure.
Yeah. Yeah, only 74 career home runs with the Twins, but like I said, the seven batting titles. He had a career 334 batting average with them.
He's one of the best pure hitters of all time. The Panamanian born, actually. So shout out to our hopeful Panamanian audience. I know you're probably not listening, but I might as well try. But he was hitting 300 every single year, except for his first two. He hit 332 his third year. And after that, he never dipped below 300 with the Twins. He's a name that's pretty much synonymous with the Twins franchise at this point. He was just a fantastic player, an 81.2 career war. It's incredible. And another obvious pick for a Rushmore for the Twins. And then your third player, Matt, who do you have?
So I have a guy who spent 21 years with the Twins. All of his whole career, but his last year was with them. Some suspect he's the logo of Major League Baseball, even though MLB says it's not a specific person. But one of the first huge home run hitters of that popularized the home run outside of Babe Ruth and many Yankees players is Harmon Killebrew. He was a 13-time All-Star with the Twins, an MVP, and a Hall of Famer.
You can't get past his numbers. I mean, he didn't hit for average like everybody else did at the time. In his first nine games with the franchise, he hit 308 in his first year. But after that, his average was never extremely high, but it's the home runs that really stand out. 42, 31, 46, 48, 45, 49 in consecutive years. An MVP, All-Star game 13 times, finished runner-up in MVP once and twice, finished third, finished fourth a couple of times. One of the greatest power hitters in history and probably the greatest in Twins history for sure. He was just incredible hitter, and you can't really leave him off of the Twins Rushmore either. So these first three picks have been pretty easy. And with the fourth pick, who do you got, Matt?
So I have the Minnesota boy drafted first overall, first pick out of high school from, like I said, he's from Minnesota. Spent all 15 years of his career in Minnesota. It's Joe Mauer. He won MVP there, six-time All-Star, five Silver Sluggers, three Gold Gloves, three batting titles. He's one of the most recognizable Twins of all time. Played up one of the hardest positions on the field in catcher. Just should be a Hall of Famer in the near future.
Yeah, I believe his first year of eligibility is 2023. So I'm expecting him to get in there pretty easily, get into Cooperstown. And I mean, I know a lot of us young guns got to see Joe Mauer play, and it was just a pleasure to see. He was so good behind the dish, and he was so good at the dish. A great all-around player, won an MVP with the Twins, stuff you can't overlook. And I know a lot of us probably remember that video of him against the Nationals when the wild pitch went to the backstop and he just stuck his glove out, no look, and caught it. It's just one of those guys. Such a lovable guy and such a good ball player to add on to it. But Matt, you know, that's actually my honorable mention for the Twins Mount Rushmore, but I'm assuming that your honorable mention is my fourth pick. Is your honorable mention Kirby Puckett?
It is.
Yeah, so I'm going to have to preface this by saying that both obviously are fantastic players. Kirby Puckett had a career average of 318, played his entire career with the Twins, was an All-Star all but 2 years, finished third in Rookie of the Year, did not ever win an MVP in the regular season, but he did win an ALCS MVP and an All-Star Game MVP, six Gold Gloves, six Silver Sluggers, 10 All-Star Games, Hall of Fame career. He could do it all. 134 career stolen bases compared to 207 career home runs, a 51.2 career war, which is slightly lower than Joe Mauer's. Weirdly enough, they actually have the same OPS plus, which I found to be pretty crazy. But here's the reason that I have Kirby in my Rushmore as opposed to Joe Mauer is that while you have similar Gold Glove, Silver Slugger numbers, three Gold Gloves for Mauer and five Silver Sluggers for him, whereas Kirby has six of each. it's the World Series that really gave Kirby Puckett the edge for me. Two World Series with the Twins, and the batting numbers are slightly better throughout his career for Kirby Puckett. Center field, another very demanding position. Not to say that catcher isn't extremely demanding, because it probably is more demanding, but both very important positions, like all positions in baseball. And I just had to put Kirby in because the numbers, even though his WAR is slightly lower, the World Series, the numbers being slightly better offensively, that's why I had to put him in.
Yeah, I understood it. I mean, I looked at the World Series too, but I think the thing that pushed over the edge for me with Joe Mauer was him being from Minnesota and first overall pick out of the draft and spending his, like you said, spending his whole career there. I had him a little bit higher than Kirby Puckett.
Yeah, it's reasonable. I think that the argument can be made for both. Another guy that I just want to give a quick shout out to is Justin Morneau. He's not the greatest player in Twins history, but he won an MVP with them. He was very good, had all of his All-Star game appearances in Minnesota, had a batting title, not with Minnesota, but in his career. And I just wanted to give him a quick shout out because he was really good on MLB 2K back in the day. And I just had to give a shout out to one of my favorite guys to use in that game. But on to the Diamondbacks.
A really new franchise. So this is going to be an interesting Mount Rushmore to put together.
Just like the Marlins Mount Rushmore from last week, it was difficult to figure out who you could really put on it. It's funny when you look up the Diamondbacks franchise page on Baseball Reference, the first thing you see is, of course, the record and all that. But whereas every team has their top 20, is it 20 players, Matt?
Yeah.
The Diamondbacks only have 12. That just is a testament to how young of a franchise they are, but they still have a pretty formidable Rushmore, I would say, at least on my list. I know yours is probably a little different because there's fewer guys that are as obvious, but the first pick that I think is pretty clear that both of us have has got to be the big unit, Randy Johnson. He won four consecutive Cy Youngs with the Diamondbacks, won the triple crown, the pitching triple crown with them, won the World Series with them, was World Series MVP, four-time ERA title, with three of them being with the Diamondbacks. He's probably the first name that comes to mind for me when you think of the Diamondbacks, and that's why I feel like it's pretty obvious to put him on the Rushmore, right?
Yeah, I have him on my Rushmore. It wasn't the team he spent the most time with, but I'd say it's one of the teams he was the most dominant with. Like you said, four Cy Youngs consecutively, almost won a fifth in 2004, came in second. But yeah, World Series MVP, just probably the greatest Diamondbacks pitcher ever.
And in a career of 1,630 innings pitched with the Diamondbacks, he struck out 2,077 hitters with a whip of 1.07. That's just, it's numbers that you can't deny. And it makes it an obvious pick for the number one guy on this Diamondbacks Rushmore. And my number two guy is another guy that I feel like is pretty obvious considering it's a young franchise. And it's the another World Series winner from that team in 2001. It's Luis Gonzalez. I can't say I got the pleasure of seeing him play in my lifetime live, at least, or at least that I remember, but he was a huge part of that World Series run. He was a five-time All-Star, Silver Slugger winner, Home Run Derby champion. And he was not the greatest ball player by any means before his time with the Diamondbacks, but he had all of his five All-Star appearances with them, had a year of 206 hits, was MVP third place voter in 2001, that World Series season, won a Silver Slugger there, spent the longest portion of his career with the Diamondbacks, was a career 298 hitter with them, with a with a 919 OPS and an OPS plus of 130. The guy was an incredible hitter for them, an incredible player for them, and that's why I got to put him on the Rushmore.
I also have Luis Gonzalez on my Mount Rushmore. Like you said, he had a great stint with the Diamondbacks. He spent 8 years there, which is the most out of any team he played for. And out of the 354 career home runs he hit in his 19 years, he hit 224 of them in 8 years with the Diamondbacks. Like you said, five-time All-Star, Silver Slugger, finished third in MVP voting, and the World Series obviously puts him over the top. He's one of the best Diamondbacks of all time.
57 home runs in 2001 with 142 RBIs, batting 325. That is obviously a year that Barry Bonds did the unthinkable. So there's a little bit of overshadowing there with his divisional opponent. But those numbers are just absurd for a season. And he kept pretty consistent in his time with the Diamondbacks. Obviously never got back to that 57 home run mark, but he was over 20 for the most part in his time in Arizona. So that's just yet another reason as to why he's got to be on the Rushmore. And then number three, I think, is another kind of obvious one considering the youth of the franchise. And that's a current Cardinal, but a Diamondback before that, and probably was having his best seasons with the Diamondbacks, and that's Paul Goldschmidt. Never won a MVP, but he came second in voting twice, third in voting once, was sixth once, Silver Sluggers in 4 years, four Gold Gloves, one of those actually being this year with the Cardinals. So three Gold Gloves, was an All-Star almost all of his years with the Diamondbacks. He was the face of that team for a while, and that's why he's got to be there for me.
Yeah, I also have Paul Goldschmidt, once again, lock in Diamondbacks history, second all-time in Diamondbacks WAR. I actually had the pleasure of meeting him in 2013, then the beginning of 2013, in his breakout year. Led the league in home runs, RBIs, and OPS that year, and won a Gold Glove and Silver Slugger. Definitely a few years that he could have won MVP that may have gotten snubbed. But, yeah, I mean, he's one of the best players in Diamondbacks history. Like you said, he played 8 years there, 209 career home runs, a 297 career average with the Diamondbacks. He was just one of the best hitters and fielders, for that matter, with the Diamondbacks.
And let's not snub his speed. He was a double-digit stolen base guy for the majority of his time with the Diamondbacks. He had 12 stolen bases this past year with the Cardinals, showing off that speed again. But 2016, he had 32 stolen bases. 2015, he had 21. His second year in the league in 2012, he had 18 stolen bases. He was a very good multifaceted player, hitting, like you said, fielding, like you said, fast. He was really a full package for that team.
Yeah, like you're putting his numbers in Arizona, 124 stolen bases and only 32 caught stealing. So it was a high steal success rate there too.
Yeah, and again, I like to put the plus, use the metrics of the OPS plus, ERA plus when I'm talking about hitters or pitchers. And his OPS plus in his 8 years in Phoenix, 145, 45 better than league average, so to say. So that's just another reason that he's got to be there for me. And Matt, I'll let you go because you said you had that some people might be mad at the end, at the honorable mentions for your Diamondbacks. So what's your fourth pick for the Rushmore?
So my fourth pick for the Rushmore is Curt Schilling. He spent 4 years in Arizona. He almost won Cy Young two of those years, falling behind his teammate Randy Johnson. World Series, co-World Series, or NLCS MVP, co-World Series MVP with Randy Johnson. He had two All-Star appearances in his 4 years in Arizona. He led the league in games started in Arizona. So I think he was one of the staples of that 2001 team that helped them win a World Series. After the in their third year being a franchise, and I'd say he's one of the most recognizable faces to wear Diamondbacks hat.
See, I have a little bit of a different take because Schilling is going to be my honorable mention. I'll get to my fourth pick for the Rushmore in a moment, but I couldn't really put him on the Rushmore considering he only pitched for 4 years and really only 3.5 years for the D-backs. Obviously, he finished in second in Cy Young 2 of those years. His strikeout to walk ratio in those 2 years was best in the MLB. He led the MLB in innings pitched in 2001, gave up the least home runs of any pitcher in the NL that year, and started 35 games, 6 complete games, only 1 shutout. He was striking guys out 293 that year, and he was fantastic for the Diamondbacks, don't get me wrong, but I really think of him more as a Philly, honestly. I know he won the ring in Arizona, so that's a little bit of a sway, but just because of that and because he didn't spend that long of a time in Arizona is why he had to be my honorable mention instead of my fourth pick on my Rushmore.
For me, I think I put him as my fourth because if the Diamondbacks have been a good team for a little bit longer and they had a few more guys that spent 15, 20 years there, I would definitely probably put them over Schilling, but he had his best years in Arizona, and while it was only 4 years, like we said, it's a young franchise, so it's hard to find those fourth and fifth guys for honorable mention.
Now, see, here's the real reason that I put my fourth over Curt Schilling is that the Cy Young runner-up twice is there with the D-backs, but my fourth pick for the Rushmore also has Cy Young runner-up 2 times in back-to-back years. And also won a Cy Young with the Diamondbacks the year prior to that. His only 3 All-Star game appearances in an abbreviated 7-year career, it's Brandon Webb. His career did get unfortunately cut short by injuries. He came up in 2003, pitched until 2009, where he only pitched in 1 game, 4 innings, then had a career-ending injury. But he won a Cy Young, was back-to-back Cy Young runner-up. In his 7-year career, he had an ERA of 3.27 in 199 games, 198 started, 1,300 innings pitched with just over 1,000 strikeouts, a whip of 1.2, and came third in rookie of the year voting his rookie year. Was never a guy that walked a ton of guys, didn't strike out a ton either, but he did not give up a lot of hits either. He was just a fantastic pitcher in his unfortunately abbreviated career. Honestly, could maybe still be chucking it today if he hadn't gotten hurt. And a career Diamondback, that's why I'm going to have to put Brandon Webb ahead of Schilling. Because again, I think of him as a D-back, won the Cy Young with the D-backs. Obviously, probably the only reason that Schilling didn't win with the D-backs was because of Randy Johnson. But I again think of him not as a Diamondback. First thing that comes to my head is Phillies and Sox. So that's why I had to put Brandon Webb slightly above him and throw him on the Rushmore as opposed to standing next to the Rushmore.
Right, and by honorable mention, while he is not in the top players on Baseball Reference in WAR, he is 9th all-time in offensive WAR for the Diamondbacks and 6th all-time in defensive WAR. He has the 9th most games played in Diamondbacks history with 773. He leads the Diamondbacks all time in triples with 8 more than David Peralta. And while he didn't put up the best numbers in his career, I am taking Stephen Drew as my honorable mention. He was a first round pick by the Diamondbacks back in 2004. And he started in his MLB career in 2006 and played with the Diamondbacks until 2012. In his 7 years in Arizona, he hit .266, which is his highest average with any team. He averaged about 10 home runs a year with the Diamondbacks, hitting .72 in 7 years. One of the best defensive shortstops for the Diamondbacks, other than maybe Nick Ahmed. He finished 26th in MVP voting, which is the only award he has with the Diamondbacks. But I remember being able to watch those Diamondbacks in 2007, 2008, and just I don't know why, but I was scared of Steve and Drew putting up monster numbers against other teams.
Well, this is a bit of a surprise, honestly. I wasn't expecting Steve and Drew to make it onto really any Rushmore. I can understand the pick now, obviously. He was, again, another stud on MLB 2K back in the day with the Diamondbacks. He was obvious, like you said, he was never the greatest player, but he's up there in a lot of statistical categories for them. Played 7 years with them from 2006 to 2012 when he was traded to Oakland. Obviously, you probably love him from his 2013 campaign with the Sox, winning the series with the Sox, his only World Series win. But like Steve and Drew, huh?
I think he's one of those sneaky players that was just flying up. He's on the one of the Diamondbacks all-time things. He's fifth all-time in sack flies, which shows his small ball. And what in runs created, he was eighth. He's not eighth all-time in singles in Diamondbacks history. I think he's just one of those players that is sneakily on all the Diamondbacks like small ball category numbers.
And you gotta give him a shout-out to his hustle, too. I remember him being one of those big hustle guys. In his 7-year career with the D-backs, he only grounded into 25 double plays. That's just another testament to his hustle ability. And a career average with the Diamondbacks of 266, OPS of 765, 72 bombs, 333 RBIs. Not bad numbers. Obviously, yeah. Nothing I could do considering he was an MLB player. But it's really, I am honestly surprised that you're putting Steve and Drew in that honorable mention. But I love the pick.
Yeah, another thing is, like I said, he's not top 12 all time for the Diamondbacks, but he's 10th in position players WAR. So I mean, it's just one of those players that I saw his name and I was like, he's got to get a shout out, and I would put him as my honorable mention.
Yeah, and looking at the top 12 Diamondbacks of all time, there are a lot of pitchers on this top 12. So you take some of those pitchers out and, you know, you see Steve and Drew right up on that list with the likes of Randy Johnson, Paul Goldschmidt, Curt Schilling, Zach Greinke, Ketel Marte, a more recent name, along with David Peralta, who are all in those top 12 all time. But Steve and Drew, man. Steven Drew. I love that. Love that, man.
Yeah, he was on some pretty good teams with the Diamondbacks. 2007, they 90 and 72, and went to the NLCS. He was on some pretty good teams over there. Of course, he's there for some of the logo changes, too.
He did the job, too. He was always the guy that just did his job. He was consistent in his ability on the baseball field, and you got to love that. So I think that is all we got today, right, Matt?
That's all I have.
Yeah. So again, thank you all for listening and coming to join us on this roller coaster that we call the Arm Barn. And you know us kids, we love our pitchers. That's why we're here in the Arm Barn. Thank you all for listening, and I will see you, and hopefully you will hear me later this week.
And once again, thank you all for listening. Follow Arm Barn Pod on Instagram and Twitter. And see you guys next week.